This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Monday, the 13th of January. As Downing Street says, Rachel Reeves will remain Chancellor throughout this Parliament. We'll examine the options open to her as she tries to stay within her self-imposed fiscal rules. Also this evening, are we getting closer to a ceasefire in Gaza? We speak to the bereaved mother behind a proposal to give families access to their dead children's social media accounts. As Pep Guardiola tells autograph hunters to rethink their lives, we hear a defence of collecting signatures. And we speak to the Washington Post cartoonist who resigned after a cartoon showing her boss kneeling before Donald Trump was pulled. The Prime Minister may have wanted to focus on his plans for artificial intelligence today, but following more economic bad news, including a still sliding pound and another rise in government borrowing costs, he found himself fielding questions about a human being close to him, including this direct question from Christopher Hope of GB News.
Yes or no, will Rachel Reeves be your Chancellor at the next general election?
Chris, look, I'll be really clear. We're going to stick to the fiscal rules. That is a very important thing that we've said throughout. We set out those fiscal rules very early on in the day. Because we knew that the missing ingredient in recent years has been economic stability. We're determined to bring about that economic stability, and that's why the fiscal rules are absolutely central to what we do.
Even as he praised his Chancellor for doing a fantastic job, Sir Keir Starmer's failure to give a yes or no answer to that yes or no question was pounced on by his political opponents. As the proverbial political hares scuttled around Westminster, they in turn were pounced on by the Prime Minister's official spokesman, who later told reporters that Ms Reeves would be in post for the whole of this Parliament. Well, I've been discussing the government's economic dilemma with the BBC's political editor Chris Mason, but first, what did he make of that answer by the Prime Minister?
There's some subtleties here. So firstly, wobbly markets can lead to wobbly politicians, and, you know, Labour folk are a bit gloomy at the moment because things are looking pretty bleak economically. And let's be honest, the sentiment of the markets is one of asking pretty searching questions about the government's strategy and decision-making. So into that come journalistic questions about the Chancellor's political future. Now, it's relatively low-hanging fruit journalistically to ask a Prime Minister if they have confidence in Minister X. The answer is almost always a variation on yes, because the alternative would be that they would no longer be in post. Equally, when you're 4.5 years out potentially from a general election, to what extent does a Prime Minister want to commit on camera to keeping said person for that long, even if right now they are utterly happy and content with how they're doing? Anyway, Keir Starmer said he had full confidence in Rachel Reeves, but he didn't answer the questions that were put, which were, will she still be Chancellor at the next election? In other words, you know, potentially 4.5 years time. Later on, a couple of hours later, Downing Street said, yes, the Prime Minister did expect her to be there for the duration of the Parliament. This matters because of the questions that are being asked of Labour's economic strategy by the markets and by the opposition. It matters too because Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves are as close to a personification of Labour in the 2020s as you can get. They led the party's revival, which was absolutely framed around perceived economic competence. And that's what's currently being challenged with this pressure from the markets and the inevitable political backlash that follows that.
The Prime Minister also said the Treasury would be ruthless over public spending cuts when it comes to this summer's spending review. Is that where the rubber hits the road, if you like? Is that where the Chancellor will have to make some big decisions?
Yeah, because what they have done, the government, is that they have unveiled that budget, and all of which has gone down stonkingly well, to put it generously. They have reset their, what are known as their fiscal rules. That's their attempt to show the markets and others that they are economically credible. They are absolutely insistent that they're not going to put up taxes, nor are they going to change their fiscal rules. If they change them, they'd be able to borrow more. So if you are not going to put up taxes, you are not going to borrow more, but it is costing you more money to borrow, that's going to mean you have less money around than you anticipated. And if you're not going to put up taxes or borrow more, the only alternative is to spend less than you intended to. And that's what ministers, including the Prime Minister today, have been pointing at as to what they are likely to do and likely have to do unless the market's steady and the cost of borrowing shrinks a little. Now, what's going on at the moment is this spending review. They're calling it a zero-based review. In other words, this idea that you go through every single line of the government's finances. That's due to take until June. But what we're going to get in March is the Office for Budget Responsibility, the economic watchdog of the government, publishing its projections for the state of the public finances. And that could point to the crunch that, sure enough, those rules that the Prime Minister says aren't going to be broken will be broken unless there is either tax rises that have been ruled out or spending cuts that would then logically come.
So how much room for manoeuvre does Rachel Reeves have at the moment?
Hardly any. And that's the crux of all of this. So in the way that she framed her budget, her tweak to the those fiscal rules that she herself chooses, and her commitment not to put up taxes, the room for manoeuvre is very, very limited indeed. And that's why it's become as clear as quickly as it has that we could be on a trajectory where departments are having to find more spending savings cuts, call them what you will, than they had intended to. Now, let's be clear. You know, you might be listening to this, thinking about time too. The government spent less money. Look at the size of the state, etc., etc. Or you might be thinking public services need a whole lot more money. What really matters here is less your own perception than the perception of a Labour minister who has spent much of the last 15 years moaning about what they regarded as conservative austerity, etc., etc. They suddenly find themselves in government in a very difficult economic scenario. Some of that is international in its cause. Some of it, critics say, is made worse by the actions of the government. Irrespective of what's to blame, they're having to deal with that and make very difficult political decisions, and ones that, as Labour ministers in particular, they won't approach with any sense of relish or desire at all. And that's what is right now on the horizon.
The BBC's political editor, Chris Mason. Well, as Rachel Reeves considers her option, some backbench Labour MPs are urging the Chancellor to meet her fiscal rules by raising taxes rather than by cutting public spending. The MP for Walthamstow, Stella Creasy, wrote in the iPaper today that we need to talk more openly about the fiction that better services do not need better funding through taxation. Well, joining us to discuss that, the Labour MP is Rachel Maskell, who represents York Central, and Yuan Yang, who's the MP for Eardley and Woodley and sits on the Treasury Select Committee. Good evening.
Good evening.
Thanks for having us.
Rachel, if I can start with you. When you hear the Prime Minister saying that the Treasury will be ruthless over public spending cuts to help meet the government's fiscal rules, what do you think?
Well, we have got to look at reshaping the economy and those public services as well, and therefore investing to save in the future needs to be a consideration. But what we've got to acknowledge is we've got a very changing economic situation, because we've got a changing society, an ageing demographic, meaning that you're going to be able to raise less proportionately from income than from other areas like assets, and looking at the whole issue of a wealth tax then comes into play. But also we need to recognise there'll be less people which are economically active but more dependent on social care and other services as that ageing demographic depends more on the state. So we've got to look at reforming the whole of society, and we can't just look at segments of it, which is currently what is taking place. We've got, therefore, taken that longer view as to how we bring that reformation into our economy. That certainly isn't about cutting services, because we know currently there are so many people which are hanging on by a thread. 14.5 million people living in poverty in our country. We've got to address the inequality which we see.
Yeah, if it comes to it, then you would be more in favour then of a wealth tax of some form than of public spending cuts?
Absolutely. We've got to look across the board now as to how we can maximise the generation of income into the Treasury, as well as then looking at how we redistribute it to ensure that those who are worst off in our societies do have that safety net underpinning them, whilst obviously trying to help people into work where that is possible, but recognising for some that may never be the case.
Yuan, wealth tax, is that something that you would welcome? Is that even politically possible after a budget which had £40 billion worth of tax rises in it?
So Rachel Reeves has said that she does not want to launch another budget on a similar scale to the one that we had in October. I do think in the long run, we do need to have a national conversation about the balance of taxation in our economy between income, between earned income and unearned income and wealth, as my colleague Rachel just said. And I think that's about the overall change in the economy. I'd also just want to make
but
the point
But in the short
that-
term?
I think in the short term, we have to focus really on rebuilding the basic foundations of our economy, including being able to rescue the plummeting rate of public and private investment that we've seen for the last few decades. And we all know that the lack of investment and also the lack of capital formation in the UK is what's part of the productivity puzzle, why we're not growing as quickly as some of our peers. So I think in the next few years, that is what the Treasury is focused on and what we should be addressing.
So spending cuts, you think, are the possible short-term fix or the more, viable short-term fix?
Well, it really depends on where you cut from, of course, and not all government budgets are doing similar things. A few about a month ago, we had at the Treasury Committee, we had the Office for Value for Money come in to speak to us. And as you may remember, the Chancellor set up that office in order to assess value for money in investment. And the whole conversation we had there was really about the idea of areas where you can spend to save. And what we've seen through the austerity of the last 14 years of Conservative government is that, in fact, a lot of long-term costs have piled up onto the public purse because of these short-termist cuts that have been made to areas like the NHS, frontline services, neighbourhood policing, and so on. So you don't want to create a false economy, as I think has been done over the last 14 years of Conservative government, where you're cutting things that actually in the long term you need to really be investing in.
Rachel Maskell, just coming back to this point for you as well about tax rises, given that this the 40 billion that were in the budget, do you think it is realistic to put through something that looks or sounds like a tax rise in the next few months?
Well, we are going to have to look at the redistribution of where the taxation falls, and I think that is realistic to make that assessment. Of course, the assessments which are made, like by the University of Greenwich on a wealth tax, is looking at assets above 3.4 million being taxed, and that, of course, would be above the threshold for the vast majority of people. We must remember that the richest in the country do hold the majority of the wealth, and therefore to see those with the broader shoulders contributing more would be a sound Labour principle that we need to look at. But we also need to look at what's been taken out of the economy. We passed legislation last week to look at the private children home sector, which is extracting over £300 million a year in profits. And of course, a lot of that going into private equity. And of course, that's happening in every part of the economy. We've talked about water, we've talked about housing, there are so many areas, and therefore ensuring that people aren't profiteering out of public resources is really important. And that means ensuring that services are best served and transformed in our public sector, and of course, bringing that transformation is more possible when services are in public hands.
Rachel Maskell, Yuan Yang, thank you both very much indeed. Now, this evening, MPs have been debating Jules Law. It's a proposal that would force social media companies to hand over dead children's data to their families. The bereaved mother who's behind the proposal is Ellen Room. Her 14-year-old son, Jules Sweeney, took his own life in 2022. The family believes he may have died after an online challenge went wrong, but it's been unable to get access to what he had been looking at on his social media accounts. We'll hear from her in just a moment. First, though, Theo Bartram is director of the public policy think tank, the Social Market Foundation. He previously worked for TikTok and for Google. So why does he think social media companies would want to deny a bereaved parent access to their child's data?
I can't even begin to contemplate how terrible it must be to lose your son in that circumstance and then to have the added torture of thinking that it's possible there may be an answer to why, but it's stuck on a server somewhere and they're refusing to hand it over.
Do you think, though, that in some cases social media companies are prioritising privacy over the rights of parents to know what happened to their children?
I think if they could hand over data in a compassionate way, they would. The challenge is no one has designed a way of creating that compassionate exceptionalism that also solves this challenge of well, why would a tech company be giving it to this parent but not to that parent? Why do they have the right to make that decision? I think if we're really worried about the impact of social media on younger teenagers, then rather than trying to set up a situation where parents have the right to, you know, look over their shoulder, then, you know, the alternative is we simply raise the age at which teenagers should use the platform and then enforce against that.
In the case of Jules Sweeney, though, one accusation has been that the social media companies have placed process ahead of compassion. Do you think that is not fair then?
I'm not in favour of the idea that for a child's account while the child is alive, that the parent should be able to read their account as if they could read their diary. I think a teenager has some right to privacy. In the event of a child's death, I think we do need a quicker, expedited process for getting to that decision about whether a parent can see that content and making sure that happens before that content is deleted. And I think that's what is there in the new Online Safety Act. It's about, first of all, making sure that they keep the data and they don't delete it. And then secondly, that Ofcom can require them to disclose more of that data. But I do think it's difficult if you make an automatic right for a parent or a step-parent in those cases without any oversight of that from some sort of legal body.
That was Theo Bertram from the Social Market Foundation. We can speak now to Ellen Room, who's the mother of Jules Sweeney. Yeah, Ellen, thank you so much for joining us. Good evening to you.
Good evening.
Why is it so important for you, for your family, to get access to your late son's social media accounts and the information there?
I think the unknown of having lost a child and not having any understanding as to why they're no longer here is impossibly hard. And I'm not the only parent. I've just been with several bereaved families that all want the same data. We all want answers as to why our children aren't here and believe that social media might give us the answers we're looking for.
Yes. Tell us about the debate and the kind of support you feel you're getting for Jules Law.
Well, I was quite worried today. I thought, what if it's not debated? What if they don't do anything? And today was outstanding, in my opinion. Every single MP agreed with my debate in the sense that we should have the right to this data. And I also raised the fact that whilst the data bill is positive and it will help newly bereaved families, that is only if the coroner demands the information. Well, like in my case and six other people I was with today, that wasn't requested, or if it was, it wasn't released. But certainly in my case, the police and the coroner never requested that information. So I said, as a matter of principle, it should be just like a toxicology report is requested when a child dies. Then you should have that information that goes to the coroner straight away. So that's one point with the data bill. And second, retrospectively, I have no way of getting that data without redoing my son's inquest at a cost of £86,000. And I think that's morally wrong.
So you would want social media companies to be compelled basically to hand over this information as if it were medical information at an inquest?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's important for... somebody once said to me closure the other day. That is completely the wrong word, but I can't think of anything better than that. Some sort of understanding as to why a perfectly normal 14-year-old that had no mental health issues that anybody was aware of, that wasn't being bullied offline, had plenty of friends, to suddenly come home and find your child not breathing is incredibly hard.
And obviously awful for you as a parent, but I think you and others have made the point, it's not just the immediate family, is it?
No.
It's friends, it's others who have the same questions as you, who are going to have their lives impacted by the death of your son.
Correct. So in a fresh inquest, if I go to the High Court and it's successful, then it would be a fresh inquest. So all those children that were interviewed when Jules died would have to be questioned again. So you're putting children under that pressure again to answer questions that they don't want to go over again with police. They found it traumatic at the beginning, and to put them in that situation that they're having to go through that again is wrong.
We have heard in just the last couple of days from Ian Russell, mm-hmm. the father of Molly Russell, of course he knew what she was looking at on the internet. He says that far from advancing under the Online Safety Act, internet safety is actually going backwards in this country. What's your view?
Massively. I think, you know, the announcements with social media and changing what's shown and I can't remember the term. What's the term when they... this non-checking of rights, you know, of what's publicised, they're removing that.
Fact-checking.
That's the word. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. So fact-checking is being removed. So you've got children that are like sponges and you're then having platforms which are releasing information that, you know, children don't know if it's true or not. I think that's wrong and it's very dangerous.
Ellen Room, many, many thanks for joining us there.
Thank you.
Ellen Room, mother of Jules Sweeney, who took his own life. And if you are suffering distress or despair and you need support, including urgent support, there is a list of organisations that can help at bbc.co.uk/actionline, or you can call for free to hear recorded information on 0800 066 066. Will the elusive ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas that would also lead to the release of the remaining hostages be struck before the handover of power in Washington? Well, there's certainly been a flurry of activity in recent days. The outgoing US President Joe Biden has been speaking to the leaders of Qatar and Israel, and he gave this assessment just a few hours ago.
We're on the brink for a proposal that I laid out in detail months ago, finally coming to fruition. So I spoke to Prime Minister of Israel yesterday. I spoke to Amir Qatar today. I look forward to speaking with President Sisi soon. We're pressing hard to close this.
Well, let's get the latest from our US State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman. Tom, positive noises there from the president and from other senior officials in Washington. What are you hearing?
Very positive indeed. I think the word from this administration is they feel they are very closer than they have ever been, albeit that there is always and has been in the past the capacity for things to fall apart at the very last minute. I think the most telling sign, though, is that we understand from a source close to the discussions that the two sides, the delegations for Israel and Hamas, are now in the same building in Doha for so-called proximity talks. So you have the Egyptian and Qatari mediators shuttling between the two. That is a sign that things are in their very final stretches, that they are working on civics, not on principles, which are agreed now. So it does feel like we're moving quickly towards the line on this, and that all the hopes are, you know, from the Americans onwards, that they will get past it, perhaps as soon as in the next couple of days. And to me, I think what's changed basically is that we have this deadline now of the inauguration of President Trump a week today on Monday. And although you have both the Biden administration and the incoming Trump administration sort of trying to take credit for their part in why it may be successful this time, I think the reality is that it is allowed for a situation where both sides, Israel and Hamas, are not certain they'll get the same terms after next Monday as they have done and will before it. And that is why I think we're, you know, racing towards a potential agreement.
Tom, many thanks. Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman there in Washington. Well, this season, Manchester City's manager Pep Guardiola has often been sounding frustrated by his previously all-conquering team's inconsistent form. But now it seems he's found a new source of frustration, autograph hunters. This footage posted on TikTok shows Guardiola talking to a group of young, apparently serial seekers after his signature.
Don't come again. I want to tell you again. I know your faces.
Yeah, yeah.
Go to the school and prepare yourself, guys. You are age. You are young. You are old.
Yeah.
You are young, guys. You don't be here. Right. Waste your time.
Okay.
You want to live your life doing this? Or honestly?
No.
You want to do the rest of your life doing this?
No.
I used to be a chef before. Didn't
you? Let's continue to do it. Prepare better.
I got bored of that.
Prepare better. What are your dreams? Tell me. What are your dreams?
What's your dream?
Well, if is autograph hunting really a waste of time, as Pep Guardiola argued? Well, joining us now, someone who's made it his life's work to collect autographs of everyone from entertainers to prime ministers to members of the royal family, including the King and the Queen, as well as the late Queen Elizabeth. Andy Broughton from Derby. Good evening, Andy.
Good evening, James.
Why is collecting autographs such a great thing?
It's been a labour of love to myself. I mean, from the age of 13, when I started collecting, right up to now, when I'm 61, I've made it a lifetime project, a historical project of covering people in every category, from royalty and politicians, film stars, captains of industries, broadcasters, musicians. They're all in there. There were about 10,000 of them, and I'm still at it. And I find it very rewarding, you know, to get personal responses from these famous people.
Well, what about irritation? Have you had experiences like those young autograph hunters had?
No, there was one not like him. I think he was exceptionally rude. Pep was, I think he's an arrogant person, and that doesn't surprise me. I think it was really bad the way he spoke to those people there, and especially when they wait to get things signed, as they did do. But back in the 90s, when the late New Labour government came in, I wrote to every minister, and I wrote to Estelle Morris, who was the Tony Blair's education secretary, saying, could I told all about my collection, could I have a signed photograph? The photograph came back, but it was signed on the back. And I always ask for them to be signed on the front so they can be shown in a frame or in an album. Well, I politely sent it back and said, do you mind signing it on the front for the reasons I asked? Well, the photograph came back, signed on the front, but it had a post-it note attached to it. And it was written by an advisor to her. And he just said, please sign the front for ungrateful sod. That was just the actual words on it. So I knew what had happened. He'd misjudged what I said. I was being polite to him, saying, would you please sign the front of the photograph
you at least you got it. And the post-it note didn't get in the way of you being able to display the signed photograph. I just want to ask, though, on those young autograph hunters, I know you're critical of what Pep did and said, but does it suggest that actually you have to be a bit careful not to be too persistent sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing is with people collecting nowadays, they're getting them and they're putting them straight on the internet to sell them. They're not like mine has been literally, like I said, a labour of love, and I'm cherishing them. If you go and get them, they are all valuable photographs of shirts by these footballers, managers. And if you put them straight on the internet, it's ruining it for serious collectors. And that's, I think, what he might have been getting at. You know, you sign them and then put it straight onto an auction website, make a lot of money out of it. It's ruining it for the people like me. I did it at a time before the internet. It was just snail mail. That was the only way you could do it.
And before selfies as well. I mean, that's the other thing that I suppose people look at. People tend to try and get their photos with famous people rather than get them to sign something these days. Is it sort of the art of autograph collecting possibly going to die out?
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, why not both? I mean, I've had pictures taken with people at various functions, then sent the photograph to them to be signed. So there's no reason why you can't do that. That's not so personal to have a photograph with somebody, whereas if they put pen to paper and taken their time to actually handwrite it, they've touched the photograph, haven't they?
Yeah, and just on you, Andy, you've actually made some pretty good contacts through this, haven't you, with some of the highest people in the country?
Yes. I wrote to Camilla Parker-Bowles, as she was, from 1995, and built up a very good relationship. She said I restored a faith in humanity because of the way I supported her. And it was rewarded. I got invited with my sister to go to the wedding when they got married in 2005. And when she came up, I said my name, and I've been sending her chocolates for years. And she said, face lit up, and she said, "We'll keep in touch," you know. And she was such a nice person to meet. It's hard to think that I've met the Queen of England now, you know,
through autograph hunting. Well, look, if that's not an advert for it, I don't know what is. Andy, really good to talk to you. Andy Broughton, joining us there from Derby. Good to talk to you. Now, Sir Keir Starmer may be getting used to being asked whether he has confidence in his ministers. The current focus is on Rachel Reeves, but that came soon after another minister referred herself to the government's advisor on ministerial standards. The Treasury Minister, who's responsible for tackling corruption, Tulip Siddique, took that decision after questions were raised about whether she'd benefited materially from links to the Awami League, the Bangladesh political party led by the Labour MP's aunt, Sheikh Hasina. She was ousted as ruler of Bangladesh last summer following a security crackdown on student-led protesters. And over the weekend, that country's current interim Prime Minister, Mohamed Yunus, called on Tulip Siddique to apologise. The Conservatives say the Prime Minister needs to sack her. She, Tulip Siddique, has denied any wrongdoing. Well, to get the perspective on this from Bangladesh, I spoke to David Bergman. He's a journalist who's lived and reported from there for 13 years, and that's before, he says, he was forced to leave by the Awami League government.
Since the fall of the government, he has returned and he's been telling me more about the investigations into Sheikh Hasina and her family.
I think the big story that made it into the UK media was the one which claimed that she had siphoned off up to $5 billion in relationship to a nuclear plant deal with Russia. Tulip Sadiq had gone with her family to Russia, where Putin was in power, and had been present when an agreement was signed. And there was a claim that she had been involved in siphoning that amount of money. So that was the first major allegation. But I don't think that people quite realise that, in fact, the provenance of that allegation does not really create much credibility in suggesting it is has integrity. It was first published in an online magazine without any evidence. It was just a set of assertions. And in fact, in the very initial edition of that magazine, it contained a picture that supposedly was of Tulip Sadiq, but was of another woman. And that particular article, though it contained no evidence, was then picked up by Bangladesh politicians here and then used in order to try to get the Bangladesh courts to argue that there should be an investigation, which is what eventually did happen.
Tell us then about the political environment in which all this was happening in the immediate aftermath of the removal from power of Sheikh Hasina.
Well, Sheikh Hasina had been in power for 15 years, and although when she came to power, she came to power initially in a relatively democratic election and was pretty widely popular, as time went on, she became increasingly autocratic. And although there should have been three elections during a period of 15 years, there were no free and fair elections in that period. And increasingly, the government became very repressive, didn't allow the opposition to operate, disappeared people, censored free speech. So by the time of the student protests in July, the Awami League was already an authoritarian party with a lot of people who were very angry about it continuing to be in power. And then when the protests took place, hundreds of people were killed by law enforcement authorities. She then fell. And so obviously, in that context, there was an enormous amount of anger against the Awami League government. And the interim government that is in power now is obviously reflecting that mood of anger and resentment against the Awami League. So although the interim government is trying to do its best in many ways, there are a lot of political actors who very much want to assert a revenge against Awami League politicians. And I think that is where Tulip Sadiq is now a kind of a pawn in that.
The fact that these allegations have surfaced in the media and allegations about property she's had here in the UK as well means that she has referred herself to the independent advisor on ministerial standards. Do we have any idea of the level of cooperation between that investigation and investigators in Bangladesh?
I think investigators in Bangladesh are very keen to cooperate with what is going on in the UK. I don't know whether that is ongoing, because clearly, in my mind anyway, the allegations that have come out in the UK are much more concerning the issue of gifts of property, apparently from people linked to the Awami League. So those are significant issues that do need to be looked at, as well as her overall relationship with the Awami League and her failure to distance herself from an increasingly authoritarian party and government that was in Bangladesh.
That was the Bangladesh-based journalist David Bergman. For 16 years, the Pulitzer Prize winner Anne Telnes drew political cartoons for the Washington Post, satirising the rich and powerful. During that time, there were controversies. In 2015, the Post removed one of her cartoons from its website. It depicted the daughters of the American politician Ted Cruz as trained monkeys and was captioned, "Ted Cruz uses his kids as political props." Earlier this month, she resigned from the paper after its opinions section editor rejected a cartoon she had drawn depicting the Post's owner, Jeff Bezos, genuflecting towards a statue of President-elect Donald Trump. Mark Zuckerberg, Meta's founder, Sam Altman, OpenAI's chief executive, Patrick Soon-Shiong, owner of the Los Angeles Times, and Mickey Mouse, the corporate mascot of the Walt Disney Company, were also shown paying homage to Mr. Trump. Well, Anne Telnes has been speaking to The World Tonight's Julian Warwicker, and she explained why she felt she had to resign from The Washington Post.
I've been working in the profession for 30 years, and I've had plenty of times where an editor is concerned about a cartoon, usually about the visual metaphors within the cartoon, maybe taste, you know, whatever. And, you know, they'll have me rework it. But I've never just had a cartoon killed because of the subject matter, who I was aiming my pen at. So that was the difference for me. Believe me, I did not plan this. I just immediately realized that I just can't do my best work now.
And were you immediately of that mindset? I mean, did you think, right, this is the line crossed, or did you have to weigh it up a little bit?
Let me explain a little bit how the editing process works, at least at the Post for me. I have editors that will take my cartoon idea, because this was just a rough, to the editorial page editor. And he is the one who makes the ultimate decision. So, you know, it takes a little while to go back and forth. And then I am told, yes, go ahead, or no, revise. And all I was told was, no, we're not going to do this. I was given some reasons that were stated in the statement that came out of the Washington Post, the statement about repetition. You know, I'm not the only person that sounds a little problematic. That's a whole nother discussion.
Can I just run that statement by so that people listening understand what you're getting at? The words were, and I've got them in front of me, we just published a column on the same topic as the cartoon and had already scheduled another column, this one a satire, for publication. So the only bias was against repetition.
All right. And the second part about that they were planning another satirical piece was never relayed to me. And actually, after that statement was released a few days later, I also heard that a deputy page editor also gave the reason that the cartoon wasn't very good. Well, that also was not relayed to me.
You raised an interesting point in your Substack, as you call it. In other words, the statement that you issued to explain what's happened. You said there'll be people who say, quote, hey, you work for a company and that company has the right to expect employees to adhere to what's good for the company. In other words, you anticipated some of the arguments that will come your way. In response to that specific one, what would you say?
We're talking about these billionaire tech titans. They control media companies and news. You know, even the social media companies, you know, they also push news through, and that's where people get their news from. They do have obligations to a free press to make sure that it is a free press. So I don't think that's quite the same as arguing that if I'm working for a private company manufacturing plumbing equipment, that that's the same thing. The fact is, we now have a president-elect who's a convicted felon. And he's made more than one statement about showing that he's has autocratic tendencies. So I think people are very sensitive to the fact about the state of our democracy. And of course, a free press is very essential for a democracy.
That was Anne Telnis, former editorial cartoonist for The Washington Post, speaking to Julian Warwicker. Our closing headline tonight, Downing Street has rallied behind the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, after further falls in the value of the pound. Spokesperson saying she will remain in post for the remainder of the parliament. The cost of government borrowing also rose to highs not seen since 2008. The Prime Minister said Ms Reeves retained his full confidence. The leader of the Conservatives, Kemi Badenoch, said the Chancellor was hanging on to her job by her fingernails. In the papers, The Guardian leads with Starmer's backing for Reeves and warning of ruthless spending cuts, while The Times on its front page says PM says Reeves will stay until next election as reform soars in polls, referring to any polls suggesting Nigel Farage's party just behind Labour. And that is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'm back tomorrow at 10. But for now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
you just get sucked in so gradually and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there.
I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.